All right, well, thanks very much. I should begin by explaining Guy's absence. He was indeed scheduled to give this talk, and he was very keen to give this talk. In fact, he went ahead and wrote the talk that's appearing on the website right now. What happened was that he's a member of what's called the Committee of the Global Financial System. That's a group of senior central bankers from the major economies, plus a couple of other countries, including Australia. And at very short notice, they've called a special meeting. This group gets together to talk about global financial markets development. And as you can imagine, they've been talking quite a lot lately. Perhaps I should make one other apology that, unlike the second last speaker, I don't have anything as exciting as five-dimensional diagrams to show today. But anyway, what the talk is, it's an overview of some recent RBA work on conditions in foreign exchange markets, in particular the Australian foreign exchange market during the recent turbulence. So I'm going to begin with some information on turnover in foreign exchange markets in five countries. Don't bother trying to read the footnotes, they're probably a bit hard to read. Essentially, these are the snapshots that are done by foreign exchange committees in the months of April and October each year. One little trick to remember is that, for example, for the UK, this is turnover of all foreign exchange in the United Kingdom. It's not turnover in pounds all over the world. As I said, they're snapshots at the months of April and October, but for today's purposes, they're actually fairly convenient dates. April 07 is shortly before the start of the turbulence, which was mid-2007. And October 08 picks up at least the first part of the heightened turbulence in late 2008. So what do these data show? Well, the first thing they show is that over the 3 years to April 2007, turnover in foreign exchange markets grew very strongly. In total, across these five centres, it grew at an average annual rate of 19%. Now, that's probably not very surprising. These were three very benign years, or at least years that were considered at the time to be very benign. So it's not surprising that turnover grew quite strongly. Nonetheless, about 20% is a strong figure. But what is more surprising is that over the next year, turnover across these five centres grew by a further 16%. Now, that was a time when turnover in some other markets seized up. Activity in markets like CDS, for example, even interbank lending markets. The Governor of the Bank of England, Merv King, recently said that interbank rates are the rates at which banks don't lend to each other. And that's just an example of how seized up some markets became. Now, over the 6 months to October 2008, there was a small fall-off in turnover, but it was only 5%, so it wasn't very much. So it's interesting to ask, why have foreign exchange markets continued to be quite active when some other markets have seized up quite a lot? Well, I think the main answer is that foreign exchange itself is a fairly transparent product. When you buy a US dollar, you pretty much know exactly what you're getting. You're getting a US dollar. But if you buy something like a US collateralized debt obligation, then you're increasingly of the view that you don't really have any idea at all what you're getting. A second explanation is that there's a significant degree of centralized trading of foreign exchange, which enhances liquidity and price transparency. And interestingly, there's been quite a few commentators, high-profile commentators, that have come out in the last 18 months and said that the problems we've seen in various over-the-counter markets could have been a lot worse if you'd had centralized trading in these products. And finally, we have fairly prompt settlement of foreign exchange, so there's little settlement risks for spot transactions. And, of course, for those that settle through CLS, there's essentially no settlement risk. So just looking at what lay behind the small fall in turnover that did happen over the 6 months to October, you can see what it was. It was a fairly big fall in turnover in foreign exchange swaps. That's the pale blue bars in the left-hand column. Partly offset by further increase in turnover in spot transactions. That's the pale pink bars in the right-hand panel. So why did spot transactions hold up? Well, a lot of you will probably know better than me, but the sort of arguments we were hearing at the Reserve Bank included repatriation of funds, for example, the unwinding of carry trades, which I'll talk about later, portfolio rebalancing, which you've already heard quite a lot about, because of large asset price volatility and the needs to rebalance becoming more pronounced than otherwise. And thirdly, some people have told us that to some extent there was a shift to accessing US dollars away from swap markets towards spot markets, towards swap markets. So why did turnover in foreign exchange swaps fall? Well, as you've already heard, the cost of borrowing US dollars under swap blew out late last year, and that seems essentially to have been because of heightened counterparty risk. Now, I know that when you do a foreign exchange swap, you give me US dollars, I give you pounds. So if I do a runner, you actually haven't lost all your money. You're left with pounds, which are still worth something these days. But market risk has actually become a lot more pronounced than it was. So why didn't this get arbitraged away? Well, it seems that essentially what happened was that those that could access US dollars, for example, US banks, and the Fed has been providing US dollars very regularly, weren't prepared to lend to banks overseas, some European banks, for example. And those that were prepared to lend to these overseas banks, well, they had the trouble that others within America weren't prepared to lend them the US dollars in the first place because of counterparty risk. And, of course, counterparty risk became much more pronounced after the collapse of Lehman's in mid-September last year. I didn't point it out at the time, but on the first graph, you'll notice that although foreign exchange turnover grew quite strongly over the year to April 08, it actually dipped a little in Australia. You see it fell by 5%, which is not much. So what happened there? Well, it seems that if you just look at these data, that turnover in foreign exchange swaps actually turned down in Australia earlier than they did in the five centres as a whole. That looks to have peaked in April 2007 as opposed to April 2008. And it's also the case that foreign exchange swaps count for a higher proportion of the total turnover in a dollar than is the case for some of these other currencies. So foreign exchange swaps turnover turned down a little sooner, and they're a bigger part of total turnover, so you saw total turnover fall down a bit sooner than otherwise. But this just begs the question of why did turnover in foreign exchange fall off earlier in Australia than it did in some other countries? And basically, I have to say here is that we don't really know. And in fact, the accompanying paper of this talk doesn't really even venture an explanation. It's not because a higher proportion involved US dollars, because you can see that they too turned down a bit sooner than they did in other countries. You might be able to mount some argument that it's due to sharp falls in exchange in the Australian dollar, but the timing doesn't seem to be right because the Australian dollar, as you know, didn't start falling until the middle of 2008. I don't think it's got anything to do with the Reserve Bank's own operations in markets, because if you look at these figures, we're talking daily turnover of close to $100 billion, and our operations just aren't in that league. Another possibility is that it is the case that our banks shifted a lot of their short-term funding. In the second half of 07, they shifted a lot of their short-term funding, which is hedged by FX swaps, away. The offshore funding was shifted onshore. So maybe there's something in that. But there again, it may be simply as prosaic as these are snapshots at particular points in time, and they just happened to be the wrong point in time for this purpose. I have seen some monthly data collected by the Reserve Bank. Not surprisingly, it's quite volatile. But it suggests that the turnover was actually a bit late. So don't get hung up on what Australia did compared to what other countries did in terms of foreign exchange turnover. The main message you should take from what I've said so far is that foreign exchange activity held up very well until 2008, especially compared with some other markets. It has turned down in the last 6 months, and foreign exchange swaps were indeed experiencing some difficulties, particularly late last year. So what's been the official response of difficulties in foreign exchange swap markets? Well, as a lot of you will know, the Federal Reserve introduced a US dollar swap facility with the major central banks in late 2007, the ECB, the Bank of England, and the Swiss National Bank. It extended these swap facilities to other central banks, including the Reserve Bank of Australia. In 2008, and in October 2008, it essentially made the supply of US dollars under these facilities unlimited at several central banks, the original three plus the Bank of Japan. So how this works is that the central bank, not the Fed, but the other central bank, auctions US dollars to local banks. We do this. We run a multi-price tender. I think the cutoff rate is the US OIS rate plus 50 basis points. We accept any bids above that, so that determines the total amount of US dollars that the market wants from us. We then do a foreign exchange swap with the Federal Reserve to get that amount of US dollars. We deposit $8 in their account with us. We then lend the US dollars to our market, and they give it under repo. They give us Australian dollar securities in return. And from what we can tell, what the Australian banks have been doing with these US dollars, because you might think, well, we've been busy telling everyone that the Australian banks are in very good shape. Why have they needed to participate in such a facility? Why have they had trouble getting US dollars? And the answer seems to be, both anecdotally and in some official ABS statistics for the September quarter at least, we don't have them for the December quarter yet, is that our banks have appeared to have on-lent a fair amount of these proceeds to banks offshore. So what they're doing is they're part of this recycling effort to help ease pressures in foreign exchange markets. Now, I haven't actually talked about this graph yet, but you need to be a bit careful with this graph, because what the orange bars show is it's the change in the dollar amount of daily turnover in each of these currency pairs over the 6 months to October. And the blue bars show the amounts outstanding. So one's turnover and one's outstandings. But the blue bars show the amount outstanding made available through these swap facilities with the Federal Reserve. Although it's apples and oranges, you can see there's a fairly clear pattern here where the fall in turnover has been most pronounced, particularly in US dollar euro swaps. The amount of US dollars provided under this facility has been the greatest. And there are indeed signs that the facility is working. Coverage ratios at the auctions are coming down. At one of our auctions, there were no bids at all, which is no skin off our nose. It's quite a good result. And the bids that people are paying are becoming, the bids that people are offering are becoming less aggressive. So don't look at this and think, don't make the mistake of thinking, well, and I have read this in a couple of places, these swap facilities actually displace private activity. To my mind, it's very much the opposite, in that there was considerable problems in swap markets because of counterparty risk, and the Federal Reserve swap facility with another central banks has helped step into the breach. So moving away from turnover now, I'm going to talk a little bit about how the number of A-dollar, US dollar interdealer trades relates to movements in the Australian US dollar exchange rate. This is all building up to what's been happening because of swings in news and risk appetite. So what the graph here shows is, and it's based on data supplied by Circa from the Reuters 3000 platform, is that over time, and especially at the peak of the global financial turbulence in late 2008, there's a distinct positive correlation between the daily number of trades and the intraday range in the exchange rate. You can see these blips up in September and in December of 2007, and you can see the very big increase in both the number of trades and the daily intraday range in the exchange rate late last year. The reason for this are fairly obvious. Trading obviously affects exchange rates. If you don't have any trading at all, you won't have any movements in exchange rates. And exchange rate movements clearly affect the number of trades, and I'm thinking here in particular of momentum trading rules. And as I mentioned, in late 2008, there was a spike in the number of trades and in the range of the currency. It was about three times greater than its pre-crisis levels. So what exactly explains this? Obviously it's the general turbulence. But one of the arguments that you quite often hear is that it's dealers' inventory risk. And basically this is a technical term for hot potato, in that dealers are wanting to move currencies more quickly than otherwise. Another explanation is that in volatile markets, it becomes very hard to move large parcels of currency. So what people do is they break up these amounts into smaller parcel size. In the case of the Australian dollar, at least the US dollar value of these parcels fell significantly. Not so much in A dollar terms because of the depreciation. And what you see is a greater number of trades for a given total values. And finally, this is the main point, is that the number of trades and exchange rate movements are greatest when there's news. And there's obviously been a lot of news of late. Before we start focusing on the bad news of late, let's just look at the general relationship the impact of news has on the number of trades and on movements in the exchange rate. So what the orange line here shows is that it's broken up into 10-minute intervals, and it shows the share of trades in any one day that takes place during a particular 10-minute interval. So if you like, the area under the orange curve adds up to 100%. And the blue lines show the absolute percentage change in the exchange rate over the same 10 minutes. And you can see quite clearly the effect of news. You get a spike in the number of trades and in volatility at 11:30 a.m. That's when ABS releases come out. It's when the Statement of Monetary Policy comes out. Actually, Westpac surveys, I think, come out just before then. I think they come out about 11. You see another pickup at around 6 p.m., which is early in the London trading session. You see big spikes at the time of data releases in the United States. You see another big spike at the time of the London fix. And in general, you see a heightened level of trades and volatility during the overlap of the London and the New York sessions, because that's when there's the greatest amount of news about the global economy. I'll come back later to talk about the relative importance of local news versus global news on the Australian dollar. But first I want to talk a bit about some recent news and the shifts in risk appetite of some particular investors, namely Japanese retail investors. So as you all know, there's been a great unwinding of A-dollar yen carry trades since the middle of last year. And a lot of this involves margin trading by Japanese retail investors. In the September quarter of 2008, the daily average turnover of Japanese retail margin trades was around seven times higher than it had been a couple of years ago. It was around $70 billion a day compared to around $10 billion a day a couple of years earlier. And these margin trading by retail investors by that stage had risen to be a total of 20% of all turnover in the yen. And a reasonable share of this is in yen A dollar carry trades. This graph shows you how sensitive these investors are to interest rate differentials. It's a bit complicated looking, so I'll just focus on the left-hand panel at first. What the pink line shows is it's the difference between the overnight US LIBOR rate and the overnight yen LIBOR rate. So you can see that in July 2006, the US overnight LIBOR rate was 5 percentage points higher than the yen overnight LIBOR rate. And by around October last year, it was down to about 1% higher. Now, the blue line in that panel shows the total dollar long positions of these investors minus the total dollar value of short positions by these retail investors. And then the rest of the graph, the other panels just do the same exercise for a bunch of other currencies, the euro, the pound, the Australian dollar, the Swiss franc, the Canadian dollar, and the New Zealand dollar. And you can see that with the exception of the Swiss franc, these Japanese retail investors held long positions with all these currencies. The biggest long positions were with the US dollar, which is not very surprising because the US dollar market is so big. But there are also big long positions with respect to the Australian dollar, the pound, and the New Zealand dollar. These are the three currencies associated with the highest interest rate differential with respect to yen. So how have they performed? Well, the green line in this graph shows the cumulative return on an A-dollar yen carry trade put on at the beginning of 2003 and continuously rolled over. The pink line shows the part of that return that's due to the interest rate differential. As you saw in the earlier graph, for at least the recent part of this period, and for the whole period indeed, the interest rate differential was positive, so it was continuously on its own, it was continuously adding to the return to Japanese retail investors. Now, the gap between the green and the pink line shows the cumulative impact of exchange rate movements. So right up until the middle of 2008, the Australian dollar was depreciating against the yen, obviously not every day, but fairly continuously, appreciating against the yen, and that was adding to the total yen return to these investors. But the sharp depreciation of the Australian dollar against the yen since the middle of 2008 has pretty much wiped out the return for a lot of these investors. If you put on a trade in the beginning of 2003, a leveraged carry trade, you'd be about 10%. The index is at 110. You'd be about 10% higher than you were at the beginning of 2003. If you'd put on such a trade any time after about mid-2003, you would have actually made a loss. So it's a very dramatic turnaround, and it probably also says something about uncovered interest parity. If you believed in uncovered interest parity, then strictly speaking, the green line would be a flat line. Now, it obviously doesn't hold, and in fact, quite the opposite holds in the short run, in that the higher the interest rate, the greater the appreciation of that currency. But it does seem to be that there is some adjustment in the long run, but it's a particularly bumpy one. Now, just looking a bit more carefully at the behaviour of these investors and the exchange rate more closely, you can see what happens is that to reduce risk, these investor accounts contain stop loss constraints that automatically reduce positions once losses hit a maximum amount. As a result, positions can unwind quite quickly given a sharp change in exchange rate, and these unwinds can compound exchange rate movements. And that's exactly what happened around August 2007 and October 2008. There were big falls in net positions at those times, the blue line, and there were big falls in the exchange rate at those times. So in August 2007 and October 2008. Now, October 2008, as I've mentioned and lots of others have mentioned, was a particularly turbulent time. So I just want to go back and talk a bit more about liquidity at that time, by way of talking a little bit about the Reserve Bank's interventions in the foreign exchange market at that time. Earlier on, I showed a couple of graphs comparing the number of trades with exchange rate movements, but most of you would agree that a better measure of liquidity than the number of trades is actually the bid-ask spread. Normally, for example, on average over this period, 2002 to 2008, the two are fairly well negatively correlated. Bid-ask spreads are highest at the time of the day when the number of trades happening is at its lowest. But they're not that well correlated. And you can see that during most of the day, or most of the 24-hour period, despite there being a distinct pattern in the number of trades that I talked about earlier, bid-ask spreads typically don't move around very much. And there can also be periods when the number of trades goes up, despite liquidity clearly having deteriorated. And October is a prime example of that. So if you look at the green bars, you can see bid-ask spreads for the Australian dollar and how they increased in October, despite the fact that the number of trades at the time actually went up. Now, those numbers in this graph actually don't look very dramatic at all, but they're an average over the whole month of October. There are obviously days when bid-ask spreads were much wider than that, and in particular, there were times of the night when they were very much wider than that. So what was going on? Well, the sort of arguments we've heard and that you've all heard and know about is that the Australian dollar fell sharply. Investors closed out A-dollar positions for a number of reasons. I just talked about the Japanese retail investors. They're a case of how, in some cases, high-yielding currencies suddenly became assumed to be high-risk currencies. In other cases, profitable A-dollar investments were closed out to offset losses in other asset classes. In some cases, institutional managers were reducing their forward purchases of Australian dollars as the value of their offshore investments fell. And basically, this collapse in liquidity was compounding the volatility, was increasing transaction costs, and it was potentially raising the risk premium attached to A-dollar assets. So as you all know, we intervened at this time. We intervened, half a dozen, 10 times in October and a few times in November for a total amount of, say, $3.5 billion, I think it was. But the important point I want to make about all of this is that unlike some earlier occasions when we've intervened, we did not intervene to try and achieve a particular level of the exchange rate. It was very much a case that we were intervening to provide liquidity and just help market functioning. And very briefly, if you just look at a few other currencies, you can see that what happened to the bid-ask spreads for the Australian dollar were not much different to what happened in other currencies. The proportional increase in bid-ask spreads for the pound and the Canadian dollar were pretty much the same. I've seen data for yen, US dollar, and US dollar, which show a fairly similar picture. But I'm going to finish up with a couple of graphs that look a bit more closely at swings in global news, risk appetite, and the Australian dollar. In particular, there was a high correlation between the Australian dollar and other asset prices late last year. Now, this was particularly noticeable with respect to late movements in the S&P 500 each day. So what this graph shows is it's the correlation, a two-month rolling correlation, between movements in the A-dollar-US dollar over a two-hour period and movements in the S&P 500 over the same 2 hours. And you can see from the red line that late last year, the correlation between movements in the S&P in its last 2 hours of trading and in the A-dollar against the US dollar at the same time was as high as 0.9, which is very high indeed. Well, there's two puzzles here. One of them is, why were there such large movements so late in the trading of the S&P 500? And that's definitely beyond the scope of this talk. And the other one was, why was the Australian dollar so sensitive to these movements? Well, it's pretty much the reasons that I and others have already talked about today. It's the unwinding of various hedges and heightened risk aversion. It's also the anticipation of Asian currencies following suit, so people acting on a correlated currency. And it's also basically something that's been true for many, many years, and that's the Australian dollar is very pro the global cycle. And you can see that from this final graph. And so what you saw in October last year, for an example, was an accentuation of the pattern observed for a number of years, in that much of the movement in the Australian dollar occurs offshore, notwithstanding the release of Australian data occurring during the Australian day. And this was particularly true in October. The blue lines there shows the very sharp falls in the Australian dollar that happened overnight during this period, where in fact, over the course of October as a whole, the exchange rate, if anything, rose a little during the Australian trading time. So I'll finish up there. I'll just very quickly say what some of the main points of the talk were. That is that activity in foreign exchange markets held up quite a lot better than it did in some other markets during the crisis. Nonetheless, there's no denying that activity didn't hold up very well at all in October, November, in particular in US swaps market, and also there were particularly large swings in exchange rates, and there was very poor liquidity in some currencies. Central banks acted in a coordinated manner to supply US dollars. That seems to have had a significant amount of success. The Reserve Bank intervened in the A-dollar market at that time, but very much to provide liquidity rather than target a particular level of exchange rate. And finally, the Australian dollar has tended to be relatively sensitive to swings in global sentiment. That's been very obvious from the actions of Japanese retail investors, from reactions of the Australian dollar to the S&P 500, and from the size of overnight movements in general. That's it. Thanks.
Does anybody have any questions for Chris, please?
Sam Holmes from Dow Jones Newswires. Just wondering, given what you've just said, do you think Sydney as an FX trading centre, its importance as an FX trading centre, has diminished to any extent over the past year or so?
No, not at all. Others are better informed on this than me, but I've certainly not had that feedback at all from others in the Reserve Bank, as far as I'm aware, haven't had that feedback. So although the Australian dollar might have been particularly volatile at times, and it's obviously fallen a lot in the second half of 2008, I don't think that reflects at all on Sydney as a financial centre.
Robert Rennie from Westpac. One of the points that I obviously took from your speech was that interest rate differentials and the attraction to the Japanese carry trader, that was obviously a major source of demand and liquidity for the Australian dollar. Given that we expect interest rate differentials to continue to converge in the months ahead, does that then imply that the outlook for liquidity in FX markets probably continues to dwindle?
I'm not going to talk about how much interest rate differentials with Japan are going to narrow, but although the unwinding of carry trades was clearly disruptive in terms of movements in the Australian dollar, and it may well have contributed, you'll know better than me, to liquidity problems, I'm not convinced that the unwinding of carry trades is most obvious in liquidity in the Australian dollar. There are a number of other things going on there. As I mentioned, we intervened at that time. We don't intervene very often these days, certainly not as much as we did in the 1980s. And we're not in the business of saying we're going to intervene again if such and such happens. But I would imagine that if conditions became as difficult as they did at that time, then there would probably be a case for us to act again.
John Keogh from the Financial Review. To what extent is the sharp depreciation in the Australian currency being, I guess, a strong point in buffering the Australian economy from the global financial crisis?
I think it has been helpful. I think if you look at the Australian dollar, I'm not in the business of saying whether or not it's too low or too high, and I'm sure nobody knows for sure. But I think it's a bit below its long-run average, both against the US dollar and the trade-weighted index, both in nominal terms and real terms, below its post-float average. And that seems to me entirely appropriate, given the state of the global economy and the weakness in commodity prices. So it seems to me that it's been fully appropriate that there be some fall in the Australian dollar. I'm not going to venture an opinion on what was the exactly right fall. But we have said in our publications, the governor has said, and he will probably say it again on Friday at his parliamentary testimony, that the fall in the Australian dollar has actually been helpful for the Australian economy, as of course has been the easing in monetary policy and fiscal policy.
Chris, thank you very much for filling in. Big round of applause for Chris.